everyone. I'm fantasy author J.H. Fleming.
And I am fantasy scribbler with crayons, Philip Dreyer Duncan. And with us is the audio alchemist, Christopher himself. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys.
We're going to start off with a couple of shout outs I have right out the gate today. The first of which goes to our very own Christopher. If you're listening to this, you might be aware that the first couple episodes aren't really a week apart. And that's because I didn't know how to edit a podcast. I took a stab at it and I thought, this sounds pretty reasonable. And then Chris was like, no, this is hot garbage. He didn't say it like that. He was way nicer, but I knew what he was thinking. And said, let me have a try. And then he did a really phenomenal job. So the quality of this podcast totally goes to the hours of effort Chris has put into learning how to edit a podcast and then doing it. And if you think it sounds like garbage anyway, don't tell him. So thank you, Christopher, for your effort. Well, thank you for making me not sound as stupid on the recording as I am in real life.
Aw, it's my pleasure, Phil.
Another shout out is to one of my favorite authors I've ever met, Mark Leslie LeFay, who is the only other person I know who has a podcast. And I just DM'd him like a weirdo. Hey, Mark, I'm starting my own podcast. Can you give me any tips or ideas or things to watch out for? And Mark Leslie LeFay, being the wonderful human being that he is, offered me all kinds of advice. He is a super nice guy. Mark, if you ever hear this, I owe you a beer. And if anybody is struggling with their author career, one of the things that Mark does is consulting for authors. So check out his website. It's Mark Leslie LeFay. Also, he's got a really good podcast. You should check that out. And his books, obviously. All right, Jessica, do you have a secret project you want to tell us about? Super secret project, secret project.
Yes, I guess by the time this airs, it will already have been announced, but I am releasing both a folk album and a new novel later this year.
Schwing! Listen, I've got to hear this folk album, and it's pretty damn good, if I might say so myself. I contributed nothing to that particular project of hers. I wanted to. I can play one chord on the guitar, and I was like, let me play one solid G chord. And she said, no, I'm going to use real musicians with talent. So that's what she did. So JH, super secret album. Who are the cool people who you might have gotten help from?
My bandmate who's on every song is Jason, one of your oldest friends.
Loser.
We have some special guests. Jason. Your friend Jeremy played guitar
Loser.
On one song for us. But then we also have Phil Woodhull, who's a really awesome mandolin player that I know from my online Tolkien community. He's done all sorts of really cool projects with the Unexpected Soundscape, with the new Today's Tolkien Times. He's done all sorts of stuff. So he plays mandolin on one of the songs. And then also we have Olivia Harding and Asia Lupo from Music the Gathering.
So let's play!
Singing on, each of them singing on a different song.
Yeah, I've heard the live one and it is unbelievably good. Yes, and I'm not just saying that, but all the people that I ran around playing it in front of today said so as well.
Did you play it for people?
Maybe. Would you be mad if I said I played it for like 1,000 people?
No, but...
Okay, good. It was like you? Three. It was three people. They were very impressed.
Yeah?
Yeah, they were super impressed.
Nice.
I'm excited for you. It's really good.
Yeah.
So what made you want to do this?
Before, I wanted to be a writer. I actually wanted to be a singer. I basically wanted to be Sarah Brightman, if you know who that is. She's a famous soprano, used to do Broadway shows and then started a solo career. She was married to Andrew Lloyd Webber at one point. The role of Christine in Phantom of the Opera was written for her. She was the first Christine.
Repo, the Genetic Opera?
She was in that too. Yeah, she was in that as well.
Amazing.
Yes.
Such a unique voice.
Phenomenal. Yes. So I've always looked up to her and I basically just wanted to do that where I'm singing those style of songs, not necessarily all opera, but all with that soprano sound. And then I used to do talent shows and contests and whatnot. And I would get really bad stage fright, but I'd always been a huge fan of books and writing. And so as I got older, I just kind of transitioned to that because writing is like, oh, I don't have to be up in front of anyone or say or do things. And that seems like something I would like a little more, I guess. But I always still had this passion for music, just not the performing, though that is getting better as I've done more conventions and whatnot. Anyway, once I made that transition, occasionally my mom would ask me to make her a burn CD of me singing. And some of them I'd have my old soundtracks from when I was in high school, and I would just upload that and then add my vocals and burn them all on a disc for her. I even did some a cappella. But I got the idea to do a folk album one and decided, you know, I could actually try to sell this the way I do my books. I wouldn't necessarily have to perform, though I'm not ruling that out completely. But right now I can make the album and sell it and see how it does and then go from there. I decided for that, I got Phil's friend Jason. He's been working on every song with me. We got
Loser.
Basically the last few things recorded tonight, some little tweaks we had to make, and then we're ready to send pretty much all of it off for mastering at this point, waiting on one more song. One of our featured guests has her part still to do.
Sounds damn good. Damn good. And I have, believe it or not, photographic evidence of JH playing music right out in public with another musician. True story. Yes, I don't even think she saw me take the picture. I took a picture of you with Lady Nancy.
On purpose. I don't think you've even shown me that picture.
Yeah, I haven't.
Yes, it was on purpose. At our Ren Faire, there's a Friends of the Festival group. It's often shortened to FOF. So there's an FOF booth area where we have our own private patio, free water, free snacks all day. So we were going there, and then the kind of coordinator, the one who runs everything, Stephanie, was in the booth, and she was just holding a ukulele and playing while she's just hanging out and talking to people. And I noticed hers was a Luna, which is what my new one is. And so I was talking with her about that and told her about mine. She's like, oh, you have to bring it and play with me. And that's what started all of that. So I took it a few times. I played with her, played with another of the performers named Lady Nancy. She plays hammered dulcimer. And so she wanted me to play with her as well.
Lady Nancy can rock a hammered dulcimer.
Mm-hmm.
She kills Ambletown every time. Now that we're talking about it, the Ren Faire being over makes me sad. No more chimney rolls. But get this, Christopher. We walked up on the last morning to the chimney roll station, and our chimney roll friend, the captain of chimney rolls, I was like, it's my last one. I can't decide what I want. And I was like, I better go with the Tutti Frutti for my last one. And he was like, what was it between? And I was like, oh, s'mores or Tutti Frutti. And he was like, I'm going to hook you up and give you a free one. You're my best customer.
Nice.
He did.
True story. Customer number one. That's me.
All the chimney rolls.
And I was right, by the way, when I was like, they're probably going far away where I'm not going to be able to chase them down. They're headed to like, what did he say? Idaho?
Yeah, something like that.
I'm not going to Idaho for a chimney roll. And then he said they might end up back in Europe for a while. So yeah, you're probably going to have to wait till next year, which is a bummer. The Ren Faire's over. That's a bummer. We already mentioned Lady Nancy. She's amazing. Love you, Lady Nancy. We love Angus, the angry Scots who yells at people as they pass by. I would occasionally find like a nail on the ground that had fallen out of something, and I would just take it to him, and then he would sit there and try to sell it to people.
Yes.
It was pretty amusing. And then obviously Music the Gathering, those guys are amazing. We love them. They're super awesome. Jessica did the book with them, and then they're helping her with her album. So they're super
two
amazing.
Books now.
Two books now, yeah. Who else from the Ren Faire deserves a shout out?
Pretty much all of the cast members. Specifically, I'm going to mention Timbo first, because that first weekend with your uncle, he was phenomenal. So,
yeah, he helped us out with a medical emergency. That was really cool.
Yeah.
The whole cast and crew is phenomenal. They do a great job. They stay in character. They're super great. Can't say enough good things about them. All right. Well, I guess we'll see them in a year. In the meantime,
We might see some of them if we're going to this Kansas City Renaissance Festival.
Yeah, so Angus, Lady Nancy for sure.
Sir Alistair mentioned Alistair. That's his home fair.
There's a company called Boar's Head Leather who took really good care of us. I've bought several notebook covers from them that are really cool. But this year, JH put some money aside to get like a really cool leather belt from them. So we went in, we picked the leather belt. She took it up and they sized it, cut it, went to finish it out for her. And there was a mishap. Some of the tanning solution, I don't know what you call it, got spilled on the belt and ruined it. They were like, yeah, we're not sure if we have this pattern with us, not sure what we can do, but we'll try to make it right and get you the same one again. And the very next weekend when we walked in, they had it ready for her when we got there. So that was amazing. And then they made her like a really cool, I don't know what you call it.
Like a leather hair barrette.
Yeah, it was really cool of them. Those guys are awesome too. Even though we won't be back to the Oklahoma Renaissance Festival for a while, we will be back in Oklahoma soon. It's SoonerCon time. Not to oversell it, but it's the best convention in the world. Shout out to the SoonerCon crew. They're the best. And I can't wait to be there in a couple of weeks. End of the month, people. If you can get to Norman, Oklahoma, it will be worth your time. Unless you're not a geek, and then shame on you. If you're not a geek, you're probably not listening to this podcast. My friend Craig Martell, who is the captain of the ship over at 20 Books to 50K, asked if we could shout out 20 Books to Vegas. That is a conference they hold in Las Vegas every year. I've not had a chance to go, but I really, really want to. And all my friends who have been say it's amazing. And if you're not familiar with 20 Books to 50K, if you are a serious author pursuing a serious author career, you need to be a part of the 20 Books to 50K group on Facebook. It is really focused mainly at the indie space, but even if you're pursuing traditional, the advice you would get about marketing and selling your books is second to none. There's really no other group like it. It's huge. It's well curated. The admins are on top of everything. They allow zero drama. They're phenomenal. So if you're not a part of that group, you definitely should be. According to this article I found on Tor.com, Witch is not done running amok. Hocus Pocus 3 is happening.
Ooh.
Nice. I had a feeling you would be excited about that.
Yes.
I don't think they have like a timeline or anything. It might be happening.
Sisters?
I did really like the second one. I hope they actually do a third one. That'd be cool.
That would be cool. But for some actual news, publishing sales are up 3.2% in Q1 of 2023. So more books are being sold. I mean, it's not my books, but for the rest of you authors who are selling books, book sales are up. According to Good E-Reader, this includes ebooks are up 12.2% in March of 2023. So that's pretty exciting. Audiobooks are up for the 11th year straight. So audiobooks still on the rise. What really surprised me in this article from Good E-Reader, it says that when a survey was conducted, it was found that about 53% of adults listen to audiobooks. That's an astonishing number. If you go back 10 years, that was maybe 10%, if even that. But 53% of adults, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that is a really impressive number. I've definitely seen memes and graphics and surveys where it talks about like the percentage of adults who never read a book again after high school or college or whatever. And it's usually a much higher number. To see that is phenomenal.
I used to not be super into audiobooks because the quality wasn't quite there, but obviously it is today. And some of the narrators are just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think JH is going to pick up the next one.
All right. So the next is actually something I wasn't aware of until recently. SIFWA, which we've mentioned before on this podcast, it's the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association. They actually have a market report that they put out, and it'll tell you the different markets currently open for submissions, ones that recently closed, ones that are having upcoming changes. It's actually a pretty nifty little thing they've got. So like if you're curious, oh, is this magazine I want to submit to? Are they even open right now? You can get a full list of all the different ones that are open, probably some you haven't even heard of. There are definitely many on here I haven't heard of before. It's got all of the big fantasy ones, Clark's World, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, Uncanny Magazine. Yeah, I'm going to actually bookmark this and start using it because that's really cool. If I remember the name of the magazine, I can go to their website, see if they're open. But this, for me, includes ones I may not necessarily think of. So to me, that's really useful.
Last week, I teased a Barnes & Noble update. There's really not that much to it, to be honest. The CEO of Barnes & Noble spoke at the U.S. Book Show and just talked about some changes they were looking at. The one thing to me that really stuck out, though, is it looked like they were planning to open some more stores, which is kind of cool because, well, for one, I like going to the bookstore, but there's sort of this idea that brick and mortar is kind of going away, but Barnes & Noble is still out there, still doing their thing and thinking they can open more stores. So that's phenomenal.
The next bit of news, Amazon has another new change. We mentioned the price changes for print books recently. They are also changing some of their KDP categories. I actually came across this when I was looking at some options for a new book there, and they basically have different categories now than if you've published with them before. It's a little different than what you may be used to. If you have a new book, obviously you just pick, you know, whatever categories your book goes into. But if you're wanting to apply these to older books, what it will do is once you go to pick a category, all of your old ones will basically be removed. So you can leave them as is. I don't think there's anything that says you have to change them, but if you're interested in changing them, it's worth looking into. It looks like the changes are really just to try to make it easier for everyone basically to find your books, for readers to find your books, for you to more accurately get your books into the correct categories. So yeah, definitely check that out.
Yeah, and it looks like they're adding a category as well, because I think it used to be just two that you chose, and now you can choose three for your book.
Yes. Yeah, I did see that one as well.
Yeah, and the other thing that stuck out to me was a silly, simple thing, but it does indicate that Amazon is listening to the authors a little bit. They're adding where from the category, you can click a link to the Amazon store to view the category, which doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but is a little bit of a time saver if you're taking the time to research categories. So that's kind of cool, too.
Yep.
All right. And our next topic, I believe Christopher's actually going to pick up for us.
I sure am. In fact, on the subject of making things easier to find and more accessible, on May 25th, 2023, the World Wide Web Consortium published the EPUB Recommendation version 3.3. The largest focus of the version is the inclusion of EPUB Accessibility 1.1. The provided specifications reference the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which is something that web developers are going to have been experienced with for quite some time now, stuff like alternate text for images, that way for people who are visually impaired, or if it doesn't load, slow internet, stuff like that, people can still utilize the content. It also shows some handling for text readers. That way, if you have menus and things like that with an e-reader, it is set up in such a way that it allows the text reader to go through whatever the primary content is, like the main part of your story, without getting trapped. The example used to be tables were a big no-no for ADA compliance back in the day. But it also looks like a lot of what they're focused on is stuff like the metadata, indicating what features and what accessibility is actually available in the EPUB is what they're adding to it. So that's going to be really exciting because it'll prevent a lot of people from going, I really want to read JH's book, but she didn't set it up so blind people can read her book. Or, you know, I really want to read Phil's book, but he keeps putting all these pictures in it. Stuff like that.
Yeah, just do picture books. I draw them with crayons.
That explains why they're some of my favorites.
Hey, according to one of my favorite reviews of all time, I might be illiterate. This is why we need a Christopher on the show, because I saw this news article and I went, okay, cool. It's going from 3.2 to 3.3. Neat story. But thank you, Chris, for explaining that. That actually does sound like they've added some cool features to that.
It does. It says that it's reverse compatible, but I think really what that means is that older versions will still be able to be used in things that are set to handle the new version. It just won't have all the features available.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. All right, JH, our senior Hobbit correspondent.
Yes. This one is a little bit amusing to me, being a huge Lord of the Rings fan. I first heard about this a few weeks ago, and there was just an update recently. Basically, what it is this author who wrote a sequel to The Lord of the Rings. And for those who don't know, Lord of the Rings is not in the public domain. This is not an authorized sequel to The Lord of the Rings. So he wrote this, published it on Amazon. And then when the TV series The Rings of Power came out, he ended up suing, I think it was both the Tolkien estate and Amazon. It was the Tolkien Trust and Amazon, saying they infringed on his copyright of the sequel with the Rings of Power TV show. That was basically his story. So the latest update to this is that the Tolkien estate has countersued him for infringing copyright of Lord of the Rings because it's not in the public domain. He apparently lifted some different poems and songs verbatim without changing anything. A bunch of the same characters and places, like all of these are in his book. So he's been countersued, as he should.
That's not how it works. You can't just do that. No. If you could just do that, I would have written all the Star Wars novels.
Yes. Sure, fan fiction is a thing, but you can't publish and try to make money off of it. That's what copyright is all about, basically. So,
yeah, I feel like that goes without saying. I feel like if you're smart enough to find our podcast, you're probably smart enough to know that. But just in case you're not, you can only sell the stuff you make up yourself.
Yeah.
Unless somebody gives you a license to do that, which would be like a media tie-in. Yeah.
Yes.
Any word on the Twilight series suing 50 Shades of Grey? I mean, it did start as a fan fiction.
From what I understand, that one was changed enough to become its own thing, to where it's inspired by rather than verbatim and in the same world, same characters.
Yeah, that's a fun story. Thank you for sharing that with us.
I'm in some online Tolkien groups, and so every time there's a new update, you know, someone will share something, but I definitely had to share that here because it's been both amusing and a little frustrating. Like, is this guy just wanting attention? Like, what does he hope to get out of this other than just bad publicity?
Maybe he doesn't know. Some people have to just not know. Yeah. Come on, a modicum of research. Is it okay for me to write a sequel to somebody else's book and put it out there? I wonder. Because here's the thing, you're not the first person to have that idea. You would think that you'd be like, if that was okay, there would be loads of Lord of the Rings sequels. Or are you just like, oh, I can't believe nobody's thought of this. Just wait.
No. Yes. Yeah, just think of when Sherlock Holmes went into the public domain some years ago and suddenly it's just flooded with different Sherlock Holmes stories and spinoffs and whatnot. You see them all over.
Right, Sherlock Holmes versus Dracula.
There are a lot of D&D books, which all draw pretty heavily from it already. How close can you get?
So you can get close.
Yeah.
The thing is you can't reuse names. You can't be too on the nose about it. That's all. I mean, everybody understands that there's some amount of similarities between fantasy books, or any category is going to have a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. Every horror book, there's going to be plenty of them that are very, very similar, but you can't use the same names in the same places in the exact same story with all of those elements.
Right.
And it's very obvious what you're doing, you know?
Right. I was going to say there are exceptions if you're referencing. So I've read different books that will reference The Lord of the Rings. I remember reading one when I was in elementary school where the main character was like a middle-aged girl. And at one point, I think she got a horse or something and she named it Gandalf. But that's because she loved Lord of the Rings, and that was mentioned in the book. Another example is Naomi Novik came out with a trilogy recently, and her main character is named Galadriel. I haven't actually read it yet, but I'm expecting a similar thing where the Lord of the Rings is brought up and it's some sort of reference to that. But it's not supposed to be the exact same character. Like, she didn't take the character of Galadriel from the Lord of the Rings and write a trilogy about her. It's a callback, which is different.
even if they didn't reference the Lord of the Rings, I'm pretty sure it would be hard to say that a horse was plagiarizing Gandalf.
Right. Right.
It's the weirdest reincarnation I've ever seen.
The Galloping Gray.
He loves Shadowfax so much. I was going to say on it, like a music connection, there's a similar thing. So I mentioned earlier, I just did my folk album. There's kind of the same sort of thing with music where just like written text, songs and melodies can fall in the public domain after so many years. So that's basically what folk music is. It's traditional music that's been around for hundreds of years. You'll have several different bands and artists doing their own versions of those songs. You'll have different lyrics sometimes. Sometimes you'll hear some where it's the same melody, but different words. So that's because it started off in Ireland and it had these lyrics and then went over to Scotland and they made these lyrics. And you see that all the time. Sometimes they become Christmas songs. So like you have Greensleeves, which is the same melody as What Child Is This? I recently discovered there's a Ukrainian folk song that's amazing. And that is the same melody as Carol of the Bells. That's where that came from. So with those sorts of things, you kind of expect that over time. And my connection was when I'm looking up, you know, where did this song originate? Is it in the public domain or is this someone's original folk song? Because those do exist as well. But I mean, it's as easy as just a quick Google search. Like, is this song or book or whatever you're trying to find out, is this in the public domain? Yes or no? Like, it's not that hard.
That brings up another interesting question for me is, do they have something similar to a parody rule for authors?
I was just wondering that myself, Chris. I don't know if there is or not, to be honest with you.
There's got to be something, because I'm looking at a book on my shelf right now called Muddle Earth, and it's very much a parody of Lord of the Rings. So
I've got a computer. Let's look it up.
Okay, so it mentions some stuff on the back that makes it sound different, but there is a wizard. It is, obviously, the name is very similar to Middle Earth. But just based on what it says on the back so far, it sounds different enough that, you know, it could be a light parody. I don't know how close it gets, though, because I haven't actually read it yet.
So based on my extensive research by Googling parody laws for books just now, this little thing here says, can you parody a book without permission? Since copyright law prohibits the substantial use of a copyrighted work without permission of the copyright owner, and because such permission is highly unlikely when the use is to create a parody, it may be necessary for the parodies to rely on the fair use defense to forestall any liability for copyright infringement. So to me, that just reads that for books, it's not quite as clean as it is maybe for music and TV. So what Chris was referring to with the parody law, and I'm no expert on it, but essentially there's a law in place that allows you to sort of poke fun at other things, in which case, you know, you're not breaking copyright because you're specifically making fun of it. And it sounds like for books, there's some gray area.
For music, it is still the fair use clause. It has to be either substantially different or it has to be expanded upon, or there's some very specific wording and I don't remember what it is, but it's pretty clear cut when you've got it all together.
Get yourself an egg and just beat it.
Yeah. Which, I mean, Weird Al did seek permission for most of his songs.
Oh, that's cool. Moving right along, I think Christopher wants to talk to us about AI.
Indeed. In our continuing coverage of AI. Last time we had talked about some submissions in terms of AI-generated stories. It looks like Clark's World, who had been reporting how many submissions they were getting specifically from AI, says that in May, they got 700 submissions just for what was AI generated.
That's so many. Poor Neil Clark. Hang in there, Neil. It'll get better, I think, maybe. Hopefully somebody will come along with some AI to kick those AIs out for you.
Actually, in some articles from Publishers Weekly and Good E-Reader, they actually kind of ran parallel to each other, talking not only about how AI is heralding the end of the industry as it stands, but also it's opening up a lot of potential opportunities. One of the analogies I particularly liked was self-driving cars are never going to replace Formula One racers, which actually made me think of another study that they'd done in terms of replacing tech jobs. They had divided people into groups and said, okay, you guys use AI to help you do your daily job, you guys don't. And what they learned was that the performance improvement for the previously lowest performers came way up, but your already high performing individuals didn't really see much, if any, benefit from the AI. So theoretically, we could end up with, you know, your original, like Homer, probably couldn't write, but he had tons of stories that were great. Somebody else wrote them down for him. Maybe AI is who's going to write them down for him. We'll have another Homer. It's possible. But another thing that they were talking about was the copy editing process and being able to determine if you get 700 submissions, well, obviously you don't have time to go through them the way you used to, but maybe you can use AI to determine which ones are actually solidly written books. You can give it criteria to determine that to help whittle the pile down.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
You know, I do want to call out one of the things that JH mentioned on a previous episode is that there are publishers that are requiring you to avoid AI at all steps. So perform at your own risk.
Yeah, it's a good shout. I mean, it makes sense, right? It's going to definitely make changes in virtually every industry. But like we talked about before, part of what makes an author successful is their voice. And I don't think, much like your Formula One example, it's very much the same thing. If you love reading J.H. Fleming's books and I took my books and put J.H. Fleming on them, you're going to know something's not right. It's going to start with the, you know, 12-year-old humor, but also just my voice and style is different. It's not what you were looking for. And I find it hard to believe that AI will be able to replicate an author's voice anytime soon.
Right. That's kind of where I was referring to the idea of Homer's. They've had Dragon Naturally Speaking for a while where you can have it actually write down what you're saying, but for an AI to be able to take that and get somebody even who only has a low level education, they may not be familiar with what is grammatically correct, having the AI not only be able to take down what you're saying, but to be able to help you formulate it into something that isn't painful to read.
Right.
We might see some unexpected authors, though I doubt they would have much visibility.
Yeah, I think just knowing what I know now, I mean, one of the things you always hear when you're starting out is this sort of old saying about you need to write a million words before you write any good ones. And I think pretty much all of us are guilty of it, of being like, oh, well, I don't. I wrote my first thing and it's pretty good. It wasn't. And then I wrote my next thing and I was like, well, that's even better. It wasn't. It took years to get to a place where I was actually reasonably confident in my craft that I knew I can look at a section and be like, yeah, that's solid. Do I want to use a specific example? I've got one in mind, but I don't want to use it. There are books, they're mainstream, they're very, very, very famous books that when you're enough years into the business and you're enough years into your craft, you read them and you realize this author is a good storyteller, but they didn't really have their craft yet. They didn't really have their voice. They didn't really know what they were doing yet. So I still think there'll probably be a pretty big gap for people who have learned their craft from just getting AI to kind of clean up their nonsense. For example, I'm really good at craft. I can write a story pretty dang well, I think. That doesn't stop J.H. Fleming from having to fix all my stupid typos, right? Which are two very different things.
I was wondering if the example you didn't want to use is that signed first edition I have of The Moonshine Wizard.
Burn it. Throw it away. Listen, people, I'm going to tell you what Christopher did to me. I foolishly had a very brutally bad copy of my first book that went live, and I sold a few, whatever. There was a local bookstore that had a copy of it signed by me, because why wouldn't I sign a complete piece of garbage? And that bookstore was going out of business. And Chris went there and got that one existing out in the wild copy I was aware of my very first novel in all of its terrible glory. And he's just kept it like a trophy to hold over my head. Sound about right, Chris?
Indeed.
And also, while we're on the subject of people being mean to me, JH, that little evil laugh was not missed. And there it is again.
No comment.
Funny story, though, about JH editing for me. I was working for a software company and there was a business analyst who worked alongside me. And he would get a little upset if people critiqued his stuff too much. And he would kind of complain about it. So one day he's complaining about a few changes somebody called out on his latest spec. And I just casually went and pulled up one of my novels that JH had edited for me. And I threw it up on the big screen in front of him. And he looked up and it was like all these marks, you know, like page one, it's just got like 50 marks on it. And he's just staring at it. And he's like, what is this? And I'm like, this is one of my novels edited by the person I sleep beside. Do you still want to complain about the three little marks you got on your spec? And that ended his complaining about the specs.
They're delicious comments, too. I hate this.
I hate this character. I hope you kill this character. That's a real JH comment. I hope you kill this character. And I think I did. So all's well that ends well.
Yes, you did.
All right. Let's talk about the writer's strike, because I'm excited about this one. This one was the most writer thing happened this week with the writer's strike. So the writer's strike is going on to a month now where the WGA is striking and Hollywood is all but shut down and shows are being impacted. So did the Writers Guild get a deal with the studios? No, of course they didn't. But the Directors Guild did. The writers went on strike and the Directors Guild got a new deal with the studios. That's the most writer thing I've ever heard. We don't care about them. We're not. I mean, we need them because the whole world's shut down because we don't have them. But we're not dealing with those people. Let's cut the directors a new deal. Also, the WGA was like, this isn't going to stop us striking for obvious reasons.
Has the Writers Guild talked about teaming up with the truck drivers? Because you really shut everything down.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. That cracks me up. There's nothing more writer has ever happened that a bunch of writers are like, that's it, we're going on strike. And everyone's like, oh, no. And then somebody else gets a deal out of it. Well, that's our world. That's what you signed up for, people. As far as I could tell, the writer's strike is still happening. Nothing major I've seen in the last couple days. George R. R. Martin did a cool post about it on his own blog, going to Santa Fe and meeting with the WGA and stuff. And that's pretty cool. But hopefully they work things out here pretty quick. All right. For our tools segment this week, JH is going to tell us about some of the word count trackers we like to use. We're writers. We like to use word count trackers. But first, let me give my disclaimer that no one is paying us. Three episodes in, no one's offered us any money yet. So these are really the tools we use. We have no sponsors. That's why you have the terrible ads, which no train so far this episode. So they may not have gotten a bad ad unless Christopher just felt spunky while he was editing. But over to you, JH.
All right. Word count trackers. I have used a ton of different ones over the years. And that is because I want very specific things. And I have struggled to find one that does everything I wanted. So, for example, I'm the sort of writer who works by deadline per project. So we'll just make this easy. Say I start a book in January. I want to finish it by the end of March. So I will schedule out how many words a day I need to meet that deadline. So then I can track how many words I write each day. Well, let's say I also decide I want to write a short story in January. Now I have words I'm tracking against the novel I'm writing, but also the short story I'm writing, which has a different word count and probably a different deadline. Now repeat that year after year with multiple projects, and you'll begin to see why I want to be able to have a word count tracker that not only tells me how many words per day I need on this specific project, but let's say I want to write 1 million words in a year. Okay, well now I need to be able to see my entire year, all my cumulative words on all my projects. Maybe I want a monthly breakdown or a weekly breakdown. So trying to find a word count tracker that does all of that has been a struggle, to say the least.
I should have prefaced this segment that JH is a super freak about tracking her words. Yes. I will talk about mine when she's done, and this will probably only take her another 46 hours. So she has really gone to great lengths. She's tried every word tracker pretty much that exists, which is why she's the one leading the charge on it, because she can probably tell you what the best one is. And what I require is way less complicated.
Yes. Okay. Starting off, I will just mention the one I've had the longest. And this one doesn't do everything I want. It more just focuses on a per project thing. But its interface is really friendly and it has a lot of cool stuff I like. So I keep using it just because I love it. It's called Writometer. It is only an Android app. Unfortunately, you cannot get it on iPhone. You can't even find it in the App Store anymore. It was removed a few years ago. But if you've ever had it, you can go into your history and re-download it, which is what I did. You can also find it on, from like third-party downloads if you're okay with that. It's worth the try, I would say. It's really cool. So you can enter your project information, your own personal deadline, word count. You can have like a timer going. That's what I use the most is if I want to do a writing sprint, it's got a built-in timer and you can just start the timer for the project you're working on. And when the timer's done, it's got your screen to where you can enter, you know, how many words you wrote. It has a reward system that you can make whatever you want. So like their in-app currency or guavas. So you can be like, okay, for a 30-minute sprint, I get one guava. And then you decide what you can use those on. So say you get a treat of a cookie or you get to go play on Facebook for 10 minutes or something. Whatever you want it to be, you can do that. But again, that one doesn't quite do everything I want. So of course, I've got a few more that I like to use. The next one is a web browser only, and it is called WordKeeper Alpha. This one gets a little bit closer to what I want. You can enter as many projects as you want. It's got a nice chart you can look at that'll show you how many words you wrote per day. If you work on multiple projects for the day, it'll actually break that down with individual projects and your total for the day. You do have to set your own goals for like the month and the year. Also, you enter all your project stuff, but it does give a really cool graph that's really helpful. If you have to make a change, like say you transpose the number or something, making those fixes aren't as easy. I can't ever get it to make the change and then update. I basically have to delete the line and start over to make those changes. But overall, it's been pretty good. I still like using it, so I've kept that one around. But you do have to have an internet connection for that one. My favorite that I just recently discovered end of last year, maybe, I think. It's actually a spreadsheet. I found this on Etsy. Someone had created this thing and it is absolutely amazing and I love using it. It's called the Writing Log and the current version is number 3. I guess the creators updated it a few times, but it's got a different tab for your projects, tab for monthly goals, tab for your actual writing log, your monthly dashboard, which will give the monthly breakdown of all of your words for the month, regardless of project, and then your annual, which is the same thing, but just on a yearly basis. And what I love about this is all of the formulas are already built in. So basically, you just enter your data and go, and all the rest is done for you. And I can just switch screens and immediately see how many words did I write total today. How many did I write on this specific book or for just this month or the year total? Like, how am I doing? And I really love that. It's basically doing everything I want. And if I could find one that did this in like a phone app, it would probably be even better. But I do love that it's a spreadsheet that I don't need internet for. So I will say this one is my top choice. If I could only recommend one, that's the one I would go with. It is wonderful. The shop on Etsy is called Excel Intelligence, and the owner is Matthias. It is currently going for $9.99.
Nice. That's not bad. I will take 30 seconds to tell you about the one I use, which actually, I got to be honest, JH really messed with my head a moment ago because I've been getting the same word tracker from the same person for years now. And in my head, it's always been Svenja was the name. But according to JH, who's a linguistics expert, it's Svenja. So that's a change for me to have to swallow. But Svenja makes a really cool, it's S-V-E-N-J-A, and then Google Word Tracker. She puts them up for free. She does these cool little word trackers where you can put in like your goal for the year, and it'll do like a breakdown by month, and you can just put in every day. It's got some more features, but really I just want to know what's my month to month, what's my year look like is sort of what I'm after. I'm not quite as interested in going to super crazy town like she does. But Svenja's, hers are really good, and she puts them out every year. They're free, but you can donate. You know, I always throw a few bucks every year for effort because, well, creators should be paid.
I will say I have used hers. I love that she incorporates art into hers, and you can pick different artwork every year if you want, or just buy the same one all the time if you just want to. I did love that. My only drawback with hers was you couldn't get that breakdown or separation between per project versus, you know, per month, per year. Like that one was just per month, per year. You couldn't say, okay, these 500 words were for this novel and these 300 words were for this short story. That wasn't possible on that one.
For this week's segment on Creatives on Fire, we are going to continue our journey from where we talked about the Trinity study last week. I guess if I was going to title this segment, it was based on what I learned from the Trinity study, it was time for me to start thinking about money differently. Once I realized that there was a framework I could use and a target I could sort of aim at, it made me start rethinking about everything. And I have always, always, always hated debt. I hate debt and I hate contracts. But from the time I became an adult all the way through the first years of working up until just a few years ago, people would always tell me, just get over it. Get over it. That's part of life. If you need a car, you go take a loan and you just do it. You want to have nice things, you sign contracts. It's just part of what you do. And I always hated it. And once I started seeing this framework, it was like the light bulb went off and I was kind of vindicated in my hatred. Debt's kind of stupid. There are times when you need to take on debt. You may actually need a car. Does it have to be the car that goes right to what you can afford? I don't know. That's for somebody else to decide. But for me, it definitely wouldn't be today. Now, granted, I am sort of driving my dream car, but it's paid off and it's been paid off for a few years. And even though it's starting to try to fall apart on me, I'm in no hurry to do anything different because I don't want to be strapped down. And it's not just that either. When you really start thinking about the math, it sort of doesn't work. You know, if you take on debt, you actually pay more than what the asking price is, right? So every time when somebody's like, oh, I got a new car, and you're like, congratulations. What did you pay for it? And they're like, oh, I paid 25. Is that really what you paid? Because once you got done with your interest and everything, and if you're paying it month to month, probably paying 30, maybe 32. Plus, you probably paid sales tax on that as well. And did you roll that into the loan? So what I started to realize was there was actually a different way to look at these things. Using that same example, and I'll talk about investing more later on, but I mentioned in the last segment that the S&P year over year was like a 10.5, I think is what it was. Let's say you have a paid off car right now, and you know you're a few years out from probably needing a new one. That's where I'm at right now. It's the spot I'm in. My car is running great. It doesn't have any drama. I don't think it will. So what I've done is I've continued paying my car payment even after it got paid off. I'm just paying that to me. And then I'm investing that money. In other words, taking that same scenario where the person who says they paid 25 because that was the list price or what they bargained the dealer down to, but in reality, they paid like 32. My brain goes the opposite direction. Okay, what if I paid myself that same amount for the next few years, maybe even the time that I would be paying a loan, and I invest it, and every year it's growing that 10.5% or 11 rounded up? Maybe I'm actually paying $18,000 for the car. I could potentially, maybe even better if the stock market's having a good year or I have good investments, maybe I'm paying half what I would pay if I had taken a loan for the duration. And that's sort of where my brain goes now. That sort of common accepted thing of, oh, you just have to take debt, you have to do this, and you have, I'm like, no, I've found in my life, usually I'm more successful when I don't follow the herd. So that's where I'm at. That's a big part for me. And really, I think I talked about in my first segment, I had a boss who he'd had nearly 40 years into the company that I worked with. And it wasn't like he was an underperformer. If anything, he was an overperformer, and they let him go. And I realized not only was my job not safe there, it was not safe anywhere. A job would never be safe. So what do I need to do? I need to reduce expenses and jack up my savings rate. And then when I see that framework that the Trinity study provides, well, now how important is my savings rate? Well, it's pretty damn important if I want to hit any of those big numbers. And my savings rate becomes the difference between what I make and what I spend. And that's part of the equation. The next step is, what do I do with that money? Do I just put it in a savings account? Well, it's better than not. Do I put it under the mattress? No, there is no money under my mattress. Sorry, burglars. It's not going to happen. There's nothing there for you to find.
It's in the mattress.
So I looked it up just to see if it had changed, and it actually had. It actually went down from the last time I looked it up. But according to this article I found from CNBC, as of February of this year, 2023, the national average savings rate was 4.6%, meaning people were saving 4.6% of what they make. That's pretty low when you consider, like, Fidelity recommends 15%. That's their recommended, that you should be saving 15% of everything you make. But if you start learning about the people in the FIRE community, they're talking about 50, 80%, which that sounds crazy. That sounds like so much, like who can do that? But if you stop and think about it and you go, actually, if I save 80% of what I make, that means I'm living on 20%, which means every year I've bought myself another 4 years. And that's without investments. That's pretty good. That's real good. I like the sound of that. I like it a lot. So that was sort of where I went a little further down this rabbit hole of, you know, the save, save, save. But you have to live too. Listen, before this podcast, we went to a Mexican restaurant and I ate the biggest, stupidest burrito, and I've been regretting it ever since. But it was amazing. I had to put mushrooms on top of it for me. I didn't know if they would. They did. It was amazing. So it's not like we never go out and eat or anything like that, or go anywhere. Obviously, we've been going to the Ren Fair and that sort of thing. It's just that, like I talked about last time, that value-based spending, and then taking the difference and save some of it. Some of it goes into a savings account. In particular, I like Ally Bank's been pretty good. Their savings rate moves, but my previous bank was giving me like a 0.04% interest rate on my savings account, something terrible like that. And my Ally one, I think they sent an email today, they're back up to 4%. That's not a bad return.
That would, I do want to say, I think they started moving because they went down during the pandemic. And I think what they've been doing is climbing back up to where they were before the pandemic.
I also believe that's tied to just the Fed raising interest rates as well. But I'm not smart enough to tell you how that's all connected. And it doesn't really matter to me because the savings account is a very small part of my strategy. But that's one thing. Like, I always have a savings account because I want to have an emergency fund. I like to try to have close to a year worth of expenses just put aside. And if I can gain 4% on that with Ally versus my old bank, I'm going to do that because that just makes sense to me. Just to not drag this segment on super long, what I wanted to do was to give like a scenario and just run through some math, which will be hard to do because this is all audio, but I'm going to do my best. So I want to give you a scenario where we have somebody who makes, we're going to call him Person A, because I'm really creative. Names are my hardest thing. Person A makes $100K a year. So that gives them roughly $6,400 a month after taxes. I did this math a while ago, so don't double check my math. We're going to assume it's right. Person B makes half that. They make $50K a year, which leaves them around $3,400 a month after taxes. And we're going to say neither of our people has any debt. They both have bills that are $1,500 a month. And they both spend $500 a month on food and gas. That works out where Person A has $4,400 left a month. Person B has $1,400 left a month. Nothing else, no other debt. They rent their place. Okay, so Person A, or a person who makes $100K a year, they decide, based on their salary and everything and the money left over, that they can afford to get in a bigger house, whether they rent it, buy it, whatever. But let's say that jumps them to $2,000 per month. That's probably, might actually be low for the national average, but we're just going to roll with it. And then they go ahead and get a car, which I think I heard the national average for cars, the payments are like $700 or $800 now. I went with $600 when I did this, which to me is still pretty high. And then obviously because they bought a new car, that increased their car insurance. And doing what normal folks do, they went ahead and upgraded their phones, throw $100 in a month. They like to eat out. That's about $400 a month. So when it's all said and done, they do a vacation, they do this or that, and they're left with about $300 a month spare that they can invest. Their cost of living ends up just under $70,000 per year. Now, at that cost of living, at $69,600, I think is what I actually wrote here, yes, they need about $1.8 million to retire based on the Trinity study. At $300 a month invested, they will need to work for about 38 more years. That's how the math checks out on that. Now, person B, who makes half as much as them at $50,000, they decide they're happy with their car as it is. They make no change, so that doesn't cost them anything. In fact, the older it gets, they could probably lower their car insurance, so we'll give them $50 a month back. They maybe decided, actually, I don't need the more expensive phone plan. Maybe I could do a Google Fi or something. And maybe I could drop my phone bill down $50 a month. They eat out on special occasions, but they kind of cut back. They don't spend as much on food as they were, so they can add a couple $100 back, maybe. They don't buy a lot of new toys. Instead of getting an expensive vacation, maybe they try some of the travel hacking stuff, so they don't really spend too much money. This person's cost of living is $20,400 per year, which, based on the math, they need about $505,000 to retire. Realistically, that could probably be a low enough number that a bad swing of the market or something, depending on how they had their money, could really impact them. But just going off that Trinity study framework, that's what it tells me they need. But also, this person, even though they make half as much as our other person, who didn't do anything outlandish, they did what normal people do, but this person who makes half as much, instead of $300 a month that they can invest towards their future, this person has $1,700. So person B needs to work for 12 more years to get to their number, whereas person A needed to work for 38 more years. But if person B went ahead and worked those 38 years, they'd have about $10 million. No one checked my math. It's legit. And really, that whole scenario, I know I just made it up. And again, I did the math a while back, so hopefully my numbers were all right. But it just goes to show, one, how lifestyle inflation can impact you and how following the normal path can slow you down versus if you're very strategic about what you're doing. In this scenario, you could redo those same numbers and say two people who make $100,000, or even person B, you could lower that to they make $30,000 and they're still probably going to come out ahead of the person who was making $100,000 just because they were more strategic with how they handle their expenses and their investments and things.
It's incredibly important to note that Phil is talking only about people who do not have children.
I mean, that's probably fair. I wouldn't know. I don't have kids. Are they expensive?
Very.
Oh, that's fair. But even still, people with kids, they make the same decisions. It's a weird culture we have where, what do you do when somebody buys a new vehicle? Everybody's supposed to congratulate them. No one's supposed to be like, were you sure this was the best financial decision? If you do that, you're a real jerk. That's a weird culture we have. Why is that?
I've been doing that wrong.
Oh, yeah. You don't have any social skills. You wouldn't know.
It's true.
Do you know the first time I ever rode in Chris's car, a piece of it fell off while he was driving?
It was amazing.
He was like, huh. Wondering when that was going to fall off. All right. Any more thoughts on this? Am I completely out of my mind?
No.
No, you're not. I think there have been enough people at this point who have followed this path. If you are in the FIRE community in any way, shape, or form, people are already doing this. I remember even like way back when, before, you know, FIRE was officially a thing, you know, there was that documentary about the lady who just saved and invested all her money and retired at the age of like 26 or something. I don't know how old she is now. at least 50s or 60s or something like that.
Yeah, I think she's in her, I can't think of her name, but she's in her 50s or 60s. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a real thing that people are doing. It's not just some gimmick or, you know, some get rich quick scheme. It's the real thing.
Yeah.
I feel it's like not the most, quick.
It's not quick. It's a slow and steady path.
Yes.
That's for sure. But I think one of the dangerous things, I think, that is just a cultural norm for us is to just say, well, you can afford it, right? You can afford it. Yeah, you got a new job. You can afford a bigger, better vehicle. And you can. And if that's what you want to do and that's how you want to live, that's great. But for me, and what this segment is really about, is for us creators who desperately want to just work on our art and getting headed in the right direction. And while these numbers may not line up for everybody, and certainly I'm no financial advisor. Also, you shouldn't have a financial advisor. You should learn to manage it yourself, but that's for a different conversation. But this sort of strategy, at the very least, can help get a person into a place where they feel comfortable and safe, and they're not worried about how they're going to take care of themselves or their families in a dire situation versus living paycheck to paycheck, which I did for a long time.
Yeah, the memes and stuff about, I went to the psychiatrist and they diagnosed me with needing a raise. Not actually a joke,
right?
For some people.
Right, right.
Am I eating today or am I going to pay the phone bill? Oh, wait,
right.
My work provides my phone. Oh, it's lights. We're choosing against lights. Oh, that's a harder choice.
Yeah, for sure. And some people are in a like tough spot and they're not going to be able to, like when I was, you know, 19 years old, there's no way I would have been able to really start taking this seriously because I was making almost nothing, very much living check to check. But even then I say that and I immediately stop myself and I go, well, I was buying quite a bit of beer. I know I couldn't have been doing that at 19 years old, but I was buying quite a lot of beer. But going back into my 20s, right, if I had known then what I know now, probably I would already be done. I mean, I was in the workforce for the 2007, 2008 stock market crash and all of that. And had I been seriously investing then, I would have a lot of money today, more than I have. But I was in my 20s and I was following that normal path, right? Like, oh, well, I can get a better vehicle now, or I can go live here and pay higher rent. Or I remember there was a point for me where I had I'd been renting a house and I was paying on my vehicle and things were like really tight for me. And I paid off my vehicle. And a few months later, I moved out of that house and went back to live with my dad for a little bit. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, I am rich. It was like I bought a PS4. I bought a Xbox One. Is that right? I don't remember the console generations. I bought a new kayak. I bought a whole new set of like tools. I don't even do stuff with tools. Why do I need tools? And I just went on this crazy spending spree for months. And it's like, if I had been a little wiser, it would have made a huge difference. But obviously people can get in a much tighter situation, but maybe in time, a strategy like this will help them get out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
JH, where do we find out about your books and things?
You can find out more at my website, jhfleming.net. I'm also on a lot of the social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all, you know, JH Fleming, same name. We'll have a YouTube channel soon for that folk album I mentioned and different music stuff that comes up. I'm also on Tumblr. I have a Patreon where I have all sorts of cool stuff that I post. So yeah, any of those places.
You can find me at philipdreherduncan.com or on the social media things. You know what? In fact, if you're listening to this, I demand you go to Twitter. Find me. I don't care if you follow me or not, but you must tweet at me, hashtag turkey leg, and then I'll know where you need to come find me from. And of course, you can find my books on Amazon and or other places that books are sold, probably. I don't know. And if you want to get a hold of Chris, bummer. He doesn't want to talk to you. He is a man in the shadows. However, you can do this. Instead of hashtagging turkey leg to me, if you want to say something to Chris, you can tweet to me on the Twitters and you can say, hey, Phil, whatever you want to say to Chris, hashtag tell Chris. And then I'll laugh and may or may not share it with him.
I'll be trending with no social media presence at all. It'll be amazing.
That would be amazing. Let's start a campaign. Let's make Chris viral without him having a single piece of social media. I want to see the hashtag, since we're doing this all audio, I want to see hashtag I bet Chris is hot.